night was all black, so black in spite of the sparks. He could still see them. Where did they come from? He heard the fluttering again, and suddenly he felt someone beside him. A hand was laid on his forehead, caressed his face. Such a familiar hand.
What is it?
Mo. Risa. This was impossible. Was Orpheus conjuring up her face, only to drown her the next moment before his eyes? He had never known that Orpheus could write so well. And how warm her hands were. What's the matter with him? Dustfinger's voice. Mo looked up and saw him exactly where Orpheus had been standing. Madness. He was caught in a dream, until Orpheus released him.
Mo.
Risa took his face between her hands. Only a dream. But what did that matter? It was so good to see her. He sobbed with relief, and she held him tight.
You must get away from here.
She couldn't be real. Listen to me, Mo. You must get away. You can't be here. How heavy his tongue was. Yes, I can. Dustfinger is dead.
Risa.
She looked so different with her hair pinned up. Something swam between them. Spikes stuck up from the water, and Risa flinched in alarm. Mo drew her close and hit out at the swimming thing, still as if in a dream. Dustfinger threw a rope down. It didn't come low enough, but at a whisper from above, it began growing longer, lengthened by fibers made of flames. Mo reached for it and let it go again. I can't leave this place. The sparks made the water filling the cell seem as red as blood. I can't.
What are you talking about?
Risa pressed the fiery rope into his damp hands. Death. Maggie. He had lost the words, too, in all the darkness. I have to find the book, Risa. She put the rope back into his hands once more. They would have to climb fast to keep it from burning their skin. Mo began climbing, but it seemed as though the darkness clung to him like a black scarf. Dustfinger helped him up over the rim of the shaft. Two guards lay there, dead or unconscious. Dustfinger looked at him, looked into his heart, saw everything in it. Those are terrible pictures, he said. Black as ink. Mo's voice was hoarse. A greeting from Orpheus. The words were still there. Pain, despair, hatred, rage. His heart seemed to fill with them at every breath he took, as if the dark dungeon were inside him now. He took a sword from one of the guards and drew Risa close. He felt her trembling under the men's clothes she wore. Perhaps she really was here. But how? And why wasn't the fire dancer lying dead outside the cages anymore? Suppose these are only pictures conjured up by Orpheus, he thought, as he followed Dustfinger. Suppose he's showing them to me only to fling me even deeper into the darkness. Orpheus, strike him dead, Mortimer, him and his words. His own hatred frightened him almost more than the darkness. It was so full of blood, so intemperate. Dustfinger went ahead, as fast as if he were leading them along paths he knew. Flights of steps, gateways, endless passages, with never any hesitation, as if the stones themselves told him the way. Wherever he went, sparks sprang from the walls, spreading out and painting the black with gold. They met soldiers three times. Mo killed them with as much relish as if he were killing Orpheus. Dustfinger had to make him go on, and Mo saw the fear on Risa's face. He reached for her hand, like a drowning man, and felt the darkness still inside him. Chapter 63. Ah, Fenolio. In the hand of a giant. His own giant. Not bad, eh? No reason to be sad about it. If only the Black Prince had looked rather livelier. If, Fenolio, he told himself, if only you'd finished writing the words for Mortimer, if only you had some idea how this story is to go on now. The huge fingers held him both firmly and carefully, as if they were used to carrying small humans around. Not necessarily a reassuring idea. Fenolio really didn't want to become some giant child's toy. He had little doubt that it would be one of the nastiest ways of meeting one's end. But would anyone ask his opinion? No. Which brings us back to the one crucial question, thought Fenolio, as his stomach, bumped about as it was, slowly but surely began to feel as if he'd eaten too many of Minerva's stuffed pig's trotters. The one great crucial question. Was there another man writing this story? Was there a scribbler, sitting somewhere in the hills that he himself had described so vividly, another writer who had sent him falling into this giant's hand? Or was the wretch sitting in the other world, the real world that hadn't been written, the way he used to sit there himself, putting Inkheart down on paper? "Oh, come on, what would that make you, Fenolio?" he asked himself, both annoyed and badly shaken, as he always was when that question occurred to him. No, he wasn't dangling from strings, like the stupid puppet that Batista sometimes showed in marketplaces, although it did look a little like him. No, no, no. No strings for Fenolio. No strings controlling either his words or his fate. He liked to keep his life in his own hands, and didn't want any interference, although he admitted that he himself was very fond of pulling strings. But there it was. His story had simply swerved off course. No one was writing it. It was writing itself. And now it had come up with this stupid idea of the giant carrying him off. Although his stomach rebelled, Fenolio cast another glance at the depths below him. It was definitely a long way down. But why should that bother him after he'd fallen from the tree like a ripe fruit? The sight of the black prince gave considerably more cause for concern. He really did look alarmingly lifeless, lying in the giant's other hand. What a shame! All the trouble he'd gone to keep the man alive, all the words, the herbs in the snow, Roxanne's nursing, all for nothing. Damn it! Fenolio swore so loudly that the giant raised him to his eyes to look at him. This was too much. Would it help to smile? Was it any use talking to him? Well, if you don't know the answer, Fenolio, you old fool, he told himself, then who does? The giant stopped. He was still staring at him. He had opened his fingers out slightly, and Fenolio took the opportunity of stretching his old limbs. Words. Words were wanted again, and of course, as always, they had to be exactly right. Perhaps it was a blessing to be mute, and unable to rely on words at all. What a wretched start, Fenolio. What's your name? Oh, for heaven's sake. The giant puffed air into his face and said something. The sounds that passed his lips were certainly words, but Fenolio didn't understand them. How could that be possible? Good heavens, how the giant was looking at him. Fenolio's eldest grandson had looked like that when he found a big black beetle in his kitchen. The boy was both fascinated and troubled by it. And then the beetle began wriggling, and Pippo had dropped it in alarm and trodden on it. So keep still, Fenolio. No wriggling, not the least little wriggle, however much your old bones ache. Good God, those fingers! Each of them as long as one of his own arms! But clearly the giant had lost interest in him for the moment. He was examining his other catch with obvious concern. Finally, he shook the black prince as if he were a watch that had run down, and sighed when he still didn't move. With another deep sigh, he sank to his knees, astonishingly gently given his size, looked sadly at the black face, and then carefully laid the prince on the thick moss under the trees. It was just what Fenolio's grandchildren had done with the dead birds they took away from their cat. They'd had exactly the same look on their faces as they laid the small bodies to rest among his roses. Pippo used to make a cross out of twigs for every dead animal. But the giant didn't do that for the black prince. He didn't bury him either. He just covered him with dry leaves very carefully, as if he didn't want to disturb his sleep. Then he rose to his feet again, looked at Fenolio, perhaps to make sure that he at least was still breathing, and went on every stride as long as a dozen human footsteps, perhaps more. Going where? Away from everything, Fenolio, far away. He felt those mighty fingers closing more tightly around him again, and then he couldn't believe his ears. The giant began humming the same tune that Roxanne sang to the children in the evening. Did giants sing human songs? Whether they did or not, this one was obviously happy with himself and the world, even if the toy with the black face was broken. Perhaps he was thinking about giving the other strange creature that had fallen into his hand so suddenly to his son. Oh, no. Fenolio shuddered. Suppose the giant child pulled him apart, the way children sometimes dismember insects. You fool, he thought. You arrogant old fool. Loredan was right. Delusions of grandeur, that's your trouble. How could you think there are words to control a giant? Another stride, and then another. Goodbye forever, Umbra. Presumably he'd never find out now what became of the children. And Mortimer. Fenolio closed his eyes, and suddenly he thought he heard his grandchildren's high, insistent voices.
Grandfather, play dead for us!
Of course, nothing easier. How often he'd lain there on his sofa without moving, even when they prodded his stomach and his wrinkled cheeks with their little fingers. Play dead. Fenolio uttered a loud groan, made his limbs go limp, and fixed his eyes. There, the giant stopped and looked at him in dismay. Keep your breathing shallow, Fenolio told himself. It would be better not to breathe at all, but then your stupid old head would probably burst. When the giant puffed into his face once again, he almost sneezed. But Fenolio's grandchildren had puffed in his face too, although with considerably smaller mouths and breath that didn't smell quite so strong. Keep still, Fenolio. Still. The mighty face became a mask of disappointment. Another sigh rose from that broad chest. A cautious prod with his forefinger, a few incomprehensible words, and the giant kneeled down. The downward plunge made Fenolio feel dizzy, but he went on playing dead. The giant looked around for help, as if someone might come fluttering down from the trees to revive his toy. A few snowflakes fell from the grey sky, it was getting colder again, and settled on the giant's huge arms. They were as green as the moss all around, as grey as the bark of the trees, and then, finally, white, as the snow began to fall more thickly. The giant sighed and murmured to himself. Obviously, he really was severely disappointed. Then he put Fenolio down on the ground as carefully as he had set down the Black Prince, gave him one last experimental prod with his finger. Don't move, Fenolio told himself, and sprinkled a handful of dry oak leaves on his face. They had woodlice in them and other creatures of the forest floor, most of which had a great many legs, and all of them immediately looked for new hiding places in Fenolio's clothes. Keep playing dead, he thought. Didn't Pippo once put a caterpillar on your face? And much to his disappointment, you still didn't move? And he did not move, not even when something very hairy crawled over his nose. He waited for the footsteps to go away, and the ground beneath him to stop vibrating like a drum. Away went the helper he had called. Away he went, leaving Fenolio alone again with all his other creations. Now what? All was still. There was only the faintest vibration left in the distance, and Fenolio pushed the dead leaves off his face and chest and sat up, groaning. His legs felt as if someone had been sitting on them, but they would still carry him. But which way should he go? Follow the giant's footsteps backward, of course, he thought. After all, they ought to take you straight back to the tree with the nests. You'll be able to read the tracks easily enough for yourself. There was the last footprint. How his ribs hurt. He wondered if one of them was broken. If so, he too would have a claim on Roxanne's attentions at last. Not an unpleasant prospect. Although something else awaited him on his return. Signora Loredan's sharp tongue. She'd certainly have something to say about his experiment with the giant. And then there was the milksop. Involuntarily, Fenolio quickened his pace in spite of his aching ribs. Suppose the milksop had come back and brought them all down from the tree by now. Loridan and the children, Meggie and Minerva, Roxanne, and all the others. Oh, why hadn't he simply written that the milksop and his men were struck down by the plague? That was the trouble with writing. There was such an infinite number of turns the story could take. How were you to know which one was right? Go on. Admit it, Fenolio, he thought. A giant just sounded more magnificent. Quite apart from the fact that the plague would hardly have stayed down at the foot of the tree. For a moment he stood listening, afraid the monster might come back. Monster, Fenolio? What did that giant do that was so monstrous? Did he bite off your head or tear off a leg? There you are, then. Even what happened to the Black Prince had been an accident. Where was the place where the prince had been left? Everything looked the same under the trees, and the giant's strides were so long that you could lose your way between his footprints. Fenolio looked up at the sky. Snowflakes settled on his forehead. Darkness was falling too. That was all he needed. He immediately remembered every creature with which he had populated the nights in this world. He wouldn't want to meet a single one of them. There! What was that? Footsteps! He stumbled back against the nearest tree. Inkweaver! A man was coming toward him. Batista! Fenolio was so glad to see his pockmarked face. He felt there wasn't a more beautiful face in the whole world. You're alive! Cried Batista as he came up. We thought the giant had eaten you. The Black Prince. Fenolio was truly surprised to feel such pain in his heart for the prince. Batista led him away. I know. The bear found him. Is he... Batista smiled. No, he's as alive as you, although I'm not sure whether all his bones are still unbroken. Seems like death just doesn't fancy the taste of him. First poison, now a giant. Or maybe the white women simply don't like his face. But we'd better make sure we get back to the nests as soon as we can. I'm afraid the milksop will come back. He's certainly as terrified of his brother-in-law as he was of the giant. The Black Prince was sitting among the roots of the tree where the giant had laid him to rest, his back against the trunk, while the bear tenderly licked his face. The leaves that the giant had so considerately placed over him still clung to his clothes and his hair. He was alive. To his own annoyance, Fenolio felt a tear running down his nose. He could have thrown his arms around the prince's neck. Inkweaver, how did you get away? His voice showed that he was in pain, and Batista gently pushed him back when he tried to sit up straighter. Oh, you showed me how, prince, said Fenolio hoarsely. The giant was obviously only interested in live toys. Just as well for us, replied the prince, closing his eyes. He deserves better, thought Fenolio, better than so much pain and all that fighting. Something rustled in the undergrowth. Fenolio spun around in alarm, but it was only two more robbers and Farid, with a stretcher made of branches. The boy nodded to him, but he clearly wasn't half as glad as the others to see him safe. How those black eyes were looking at him! The fact was, Farid knew too much about Fenolio and the part he played in this world. Don't look at me so accusingly, he wanted to protest. What else were we to do? Meggie thought it was a good idea, too. Well, to be honest, she had expressed a few doubts. I don't understand where that giant came from so suddenly, said Batista. Even when I was a child, the giants were little more than a fairy tale. I don't know any of the strolling players who ever set eyes on one, except for Dustfinger, and he would always venture farther into the mountains than the rest of us. Without a word, Farid turned his back on Fenolio and cut a few more twigs for the stretcher. The bear would happily have carried his master on his furry back, and Batista had some difficulty in persuading him to get out of the way when they lifted the Black Prince and put him on the stretcher. Only when his master spoke gently to him did the bear calm down, and he lumbered along beside the prince, looking dejected. Well, come on, Fenolio, the old man told himself. What are you waiting for? Go after them, he muttered as he followed Batista, his legs aching. No one's going to carry you. And you'd better pray to whatever you believe in that the milksop isn't back.
Chapter 64 Light. The fire was everywhere. It ate its way along the walls and licked down from the ceiling, crept out of the stone, and gave as much light as if the sun itself had risen in the darkened castle to scorch his bloated flesh. The adderhead shouted at the piper until he was hoarse. He struck him in his bony chest with his fists, longing to ram the man's silver nose into his face, deep into the sound flesh that he envied him so much. The fire dancer was back from the dead for the second time, and the blue jay had escaped from one of the cells that, so his father-in-law had always claimed, no prisoner ever left alive.
"Flown away," whispered the adder's soldiers.
"The bird has flown, and now he's roaming the castle like a hungry wolf. He'll kill us all."
The adderhead had handed over the two guards of the cell to Thumbling for punishment, but the blue jay had already killed six more, and the rumors grew louder with every dead man they found. His soldiers were running away, over the bridge, or along the tunnel under the lake, anywhere to get away from the bewitched castle that now belonged to the blue jay and the fire dancer. Some of them had even jumped into the lake, never to climb out again. The rest were shaking in their shoes like a crowd of terrified children, while the painted walls burned and the light scorched the adder's brain and his skin.
"Bring me Four Eyes," he shouted, and Thumbling dragged Orpheus into his room.
Jacopo crept in at the door too, like a worm that had dug its way out of damp earth.
"Put out the fire!"
How his throat hurt, as if the sparks were in there too.
"Put it out at once, and bring me back the blue jay, or I'll cut your slimy tongue out. Is this why you persuaded me to throw him into that cell, so that he could fly away?"
The pale blue eyes blurred behind the man's glasses, and the flattering tongue sounded as if it had been bathed in precious oil. But it was impossible to mistake the fear in it. "I told the piper he ought to post more than two guards outside the cell," said the sly little snake, so much cleverer than Silvernose, so much mock innocence, even the adderhead couldn't quite see through it. "Only a few more hours, and the jay would have been pleading with you to let him bind the book. Ask the guards. They heard him down there writhing like a worm on the hook, groaning and sighing."
"The guards are dead. I handed them over to Thumbling and told him to make sure their screams could be heard all over the castle."
Thumbling adjusted his black gloves.
"Four Eyes is telling the truth. The guards kept bleating over and over that the blue jay was in a very bad state down in that cell. They heard him screaming and groaning, and they checked a couple of times to make sure he was still alive. I'd like to know how you did it," he said, his hawk-like gaze resting on Orpheus for a moment. "But anyway, they said the jay kept whispering one name again and again."
The adderhead put his hands over his burning eyes.
"What name? My daughter's name, by any chance?"
"No, the name of some other woman," replied Thumbling.
"Risa, his wife, your highness," Orpheus smiled. The adderhead was not sure whether his smile expressed deference or self-satisfaction. The piper cast a vicious glance at Orpheus.
"My men will soon have caught his wife, and his daughter too."
"And what use is that to me now?"
The adderhead pressed his fists into his eyes, but he could still see the fire all the same. Pain was cutting him into slices, stinking slices, and now the man to whom he owed it all had fooled him for the second time. He needed the book. A new book to heal his flesh. It was hanging off his bones like mud. Heavy, damp, stinking mud.
"Blue Jay, take two of those who tried to run away up onto the bridge where everyone can see them," he said grimly. "And you,
Fetch that dog of yours,
he snapped at Orpheus.
It must be hungry.
The men screamed like animals as the black shadow devoured them, and the Adderhead imagined that the cries echoing all the way to his room were the blue jays. The man owed him many screams. Orpheus listened with a smile, and the nightmare returned to him like a faithful dog after its meal. Panting, it merged with Orpheus's shadow, and its darkness made even the Adderhead shudder. Orpheus, however, adjusted his glasses with a satisfied expression. Their round lenses reflected the sparks burning on the walls. Four eyes. I'll bring you back the blue jay, he said. And even against his will, the Adderhead felt the confidence in that velvety voice soothing him once again. He hasn't escaped you, however it may seem. I have him bound in invisible chains. I forged them myself with my black art, and wherever he's hiding, those chains will pull at him and bring back old pain. He knows I am the one sending him the pain, and he knows it will never end as long as I live. So he'll try to kill me. Set Thumbling to guard my room, and the blue jay will stumble into his arms. He's not our problem anymore. But the fire dancer is. The hatred in his pale face surprised the Adderhead. Usually, such hatred comes only after love. So, he's back from the dead again. Loathing clung to every word that Orpheus spoke, slowing his smooth tongue. He's acting as if he were lord of this castle, but take my advice, and his fire will soon be extinguished.
And what advice might that be?
Orpheus smiled. Send Thumbling to your daughter. Have her thrown into one of the cells, and spread word that she helped the blue jay to escape. That'll stop all the nonsense talk that makes your soldiers tremble with fear. As for her beautiful maidservant, lock her up in the cage where the blue jay himself was held, and tell Thumbling he needn't treat the girl too gently. The fire was still reflected in Orpheus's glasses. They made his eyes almost invisible, and for a moment the Adderhead felt something he had never felt before. Fear of another man. It was an interesting sensation, like a tingling on the back of the neck, a slight pressure in the stomach.
Exactly what I planned to do, he said,
and read in Orpheus's face that he knew he was lying. I'll have to kill him, thought the Adderhead, as soon as the new book is bound. No man should be cleverer than his master, particularly not when he controlled so dangerous a dog. Chapter 65 Made Visible.
You must go. You're not safe anywhere in this castle.
Dustfinger kept saying it again and again, and Mo kept shaking his head.
I have to find the white book. Let me look for it. I'll write the three words. Even I can write well enough for that.
No, that wasn't the bargain.
Suppose death comes for Meggie all the same.
I bound the book. I must rid the world of it. And the adder wants to see you dead as much as me.
I'll simply slip out of my skin again.
You only just found your way back into it last time.
How familiar the two of them sounded with each other. Like two sides of a coin. Like two faces of the same man.
What bargain are you talking about?
They looked at Risa as if they both wished her far, far away. Mo was pale, but his eyes were dark with anger, and his hand kept going to his old wound. What had they done to him down in that terrible cell? Dust lay like snow in the room where they were hiding. The plaster on the ceiling was so damp that it had crumbled away in places. The castle in the lake was sick. Perhaps it was already dying, but on its walls lambs still slept beside wolves, dreaming of a world that never was. The room had two narrow windows. A dead tree stood in the courtyard below. Walls, parapets, oriel towers, bridges, a stony trap, and Risa wanted her wings back. How her skin was itching, as if the feathered quills were just waiting to pierce through again. "Mo, what kind of bargain?" She came between the two men. When he told her, she began crying. Now, at last, she understood. He was promised to death, whether he stayed or fled. Caught in a trap made of stone and ink. And so was their daughter. He took her in his arms, but he wasn't really with her. He was still down in the cell, drowning in hate and fear. His heart was beating so violently that she was afraid it might break in his breast. "I'll kill him," she heard him say as she wept into his shoulder. "I ought to have done it long ago, and after that I'll look for the book." She knew only too well who he meant. Orpheus. He pushed her gently away from him and picked up his sword. It was covered with blood, but he wiped the blade clean on his sleeve. He still wore the black clothes of a bookbinder, although it was a long time since that had been his trade. He made for the door with determination, but Dustfinger barred his way. "That's your idea," he said. "Very well. So Orpheus read the words, but you are making them come true." He raised his hands, and fire wrote the words in the air. Terrible words, all speaking of only one thing. The last song of the Blue Jay. Mo stretched out his hand as if to extinguish them, but they scorched his fingers and burned his heart. "Orpheus is just waiting for you to come to him," said Dustfinger. "He's going to serve you up to the Adderhead on a platter made of ink. Resist it. It's not a pleasant feeling to read the words that guide your actions. No one knows that better than I do. But they didn't come true for me either. They have only as much power as you give them. You won't go to Orpheus. I will. I don't know much about killing. Even dying didn't teach me that. But I can steal the books from which he takes the words. And once you can think straight again, we'll look for the white book together." "Suppose the Adder's soldiers find Mo here first?" Risa was still staring at the burning words. She read them again and again. Dustfinger passed his hand over the picture fading on the walls of the room, and the painted wolf began to move. "I leave you a watchdog, though not quite such a fierce one as Orpheus's, but it will howl when the soldiers come, and I hope it can hold them off long enough to give you time to find another hiding place. Fire will teach the Adder's men to fear every shadow." The wolf, with its burning coat, leaped off the wall and followed Dustfinger out. However, the words that had been written in the air were still there, and Risa read them again. But when the Blue Jay would not bow to the Adderhead, only one man knew what to do, a stranger who had come from far away to be the Adder's advisor. He understood that the Blue Jay could be broken by only one man, and that was himself. So he summoned up all that the Blue Jay didn't dare to acknowledge, the fear that made him fearless, the anger that made him invincible. He had him thrown into darkness to fight himself there, to fight the pain still inside him, never forgotten, never healed, all the fear that fetters and chains had given him, the anger that had sown the seeds of fear. He painted dreadful pictures in his heart. Pictures of... Risa read no more. The words were too terrible. But the fire had burned the last sentences into her memory. And the Blue Jay, broken by his own darkness, pleaded with the Adderhead to be allowed to bind him a second book, even more beautiful than the first. But as soon as the Silver Prince had the book in his hands, he condemned him to die the slowest of all deaths. And the minstrel sang the last song of the Blue Jay. Mo had turned his back on the words. He stood there with the dust of countless years around him like grey snow, looking at his hands as if he wasn't sure whether they still did as he told them, or obeyed the words burning behind him. "Mo," Risa kissed him. She knew that he wouldn't like what she was about to do. He looked at her, absently, his eyes full of darkness. "I will look for the white book. I'll find it, and write the three words in it for you. So that the Adderhead dies before Orpheus's words come true," she added in her mind, "and before the name Fenolio gave you kills you." By the time Mo understood what she had said, she was already lifting the seeds to her mouth,
He tried to knock them out of her hand, but she already had them under her tongue.
No, Risa!
She flew through the fiery letters. Their heat singed her breast.
Risa!
No, this time he was the one who must wait. Stay where you are, she thought. Please, Mo. Chapter 66. Love Disguised as Hate. The Adderhead wanted fairy blood, a whole tubful to bathe his itching skin. Orpheus was writing fairies' nests into the bare branches of the cherry trees growing under his window when he heard soft footsteps behind him. He dropped his pen so abruptly that it spattered Ironstone's grey feet with ink. The Blue Jay. Orpheus thought he could already feel the sword between his shoulder blades. After all, he himself had stoked the Blue Jay's bloodlust, drowning him in anger and helpless rage. How had he managed to get past the guards? There were three outside his door, and Thumbling was waiting in the next room. However, when Orpheus turned, he found not Mortimer, but Dustfinger standing behind him. What was he doing here? Why wasn't he outside the cage where his sobbing daughter sat, letting the nightmare eat him? Dustfinger. Less than a year ago, the mere thought of seeing him would have made Orpheus drunk with happiness. In the bleak room where he was living at the time, surrounded by books that spoke of the longing in his heart but never satisfied it, longing for a world that bowed to his will, longing to escape his grave failure of a life at last, to become the Orpheus that slumbered inside him, the man whom those who mocked him never saw. Perhaps longing was the wrong word. It sounded too tame, too gentle and resigned. It was a raging desire that drove him. Desire for everything he didn't have. Oh, yes, the sight of Dustfinger would have made him very happy back then. But now his heart beat faster for other reasons. The hate he felt still tasted like love, but that didn't tame it. And suddenly Orpheus saw the opportunity for such perfect revenge that he spontaneously smiled. Well, if it isn't my old childhood friend... My faithless friend. Orpheus pushed Violante's Blue Jay book under the parchment on which he was writing. Ironstone ducked behind the inkwell in fear. Fear? Not necessarily a bad feeling. Sometimes it could be very stimulating. I suppose you're here to steal a few more books from me, he went on. That won't do the Blue Jay any good. The words have been read, and they'll pursue him. That's the price you pay for making a story your own. But how about you? Have you seen your daughter recently? Dustfinger's expression gave nothing away. He really didn't know yet. Ah, love! What a perfect tool of revenge! Even the fearless heart that Dustfinger had brought back from the dead was powerless against it. You really should go to her. She's sobbing in the most heart-rending way. Tearing her beautiful hair. The look in his eyes. Got you, thought Orpheus. Got you both on the hook now, you and the Blue Jay. My black dog is guarding your daughter, he went on, and every word tasted as good as spiced wine. I expect she's terribly afraid, but I've ordered my dog not to feast on her sweet flesh and soul just yet. There. So fear could sting Dustfinger after all. His unscarred face turned pale. He stared at Orpheus's shadow, but the nightmare did not emerge from it. The nightmare was outside the cage where Brianna sat weeping and calling for her father. I'll kill you if it so much as touches her. I don't know much about killing, but for you I'd learn. Dustfinger's face seemed so much more vulnerable without the scars. His clothes and hair were covered with fiery sparks. Orpheus had to admit it. The Fire Dancer was still his favorite character. Whatever Dustfinger did to him, however often he betrayed him, it didn't change that. His heart loved him like a dog. All the more reason to remove him from this story once and for all, although it was still a shame. Orpheus could hardly believe he had come here only to protect the Blue Jay. Such high-minded nobility didn't suit him at all.
No, it was time the Fire Dancer returned to playing a part that was more like himself. You can ransom your daughter. Orpheus let every word melt on his tongue. Oh, sweet revenge. The marten on Dustfinger's shoulder bared its teeth, nasty brute. Dustfinger stroked its brown coat. How? Orpheus rose to his feet. Well, first by putting out the lights you've so skillfully brought to this castle. At once. The sparks on the walls flared up, as if reaching out to burn him, but then they died down. Only those on Dustfinger's hair and clothes still shone. Yes, what a terrible weapon love could be. Was any knife sharper? Time to thrust it even deeper into his faithless heart. Your daughter is crying her eyes out in the same cage that held the blue jay, Orpheus went on. Of course, she looks much more beautiful in there with that fiery hair, like a precious bird. The sparks swirled around Dustfinger like a red mist. Bring us the bird who really belongs in that cage. Bring us the blue jay, and your lovely daughter is free. But if you don't bring him, I'll feed my black dog on her flesh and her soul.
Don't look at me like that. As far as I'm aware, you've played the part of traitor once already. I wanted to write you a better part, but you wouldn't hear of it.
Dustfinger said nothing, just looked at him.
You stole the book from me.
Orpheus's voice almost failed him. The words still tasted so bitter.
You ranged yourself on the bookbinder's side, although he snatched you out of your own story instead of backing me. The man who brought you home, that was cruel, very cruel.
Tears rose to his eyes.
What did you think, that I'd just accept such treachery?
No, my plan was to send you back to the dead without a soul, hollow as an insect sucked dry.
But I like this revenge even better. I'll make you a traitor again.
How that will pierce the bookbinder's noble heart. The flames were leaping from the walls again. They licked up from the floor, scorching Orpheus's boots. Ironstone moaned with fear and buried his head in his glass arms. Dustfinger's anger showed in the flames, burning on his face, raining down from the ceiling in sparks.
Keep your fire away from me, Orpheus cried. I'm the only one who can command the nightmare. And your daughter will be the first it eats when it next feels hungry, which will be soon.
I want a trail of fire laid to wherever the blue jay is hiding, and I'll be the man who shows it to the adderhead. Understand? The flames on the walls went out for the second time. Even the candles on the desk burned out, and all was dark in Orpheus's room. Only Dustfinger himself was still enveloped in sparks. As if the fire were in him. Why did the look in his eyes make Orpheus feel such shame? Why did his heart still feel love? He closed his eyes, and when he opened them again, Dustfinger was gone. As Orpheus stepped out of the door, the guards who were supposed to be keeping watch outside his room came stumbling along the corridor, their faces twisted with fear.
The blue jay was here, they stammered. He was all made of fire, and then he suddenly dissolved into smoke. Thumbling has gone to tell the Adderhead.
Idiots. He'd feed them all to the nightmare. Don't lose your temper, he told himself. You'll soon bring the Adderhead the real blue jay. And your nightmare will eat the Fire Dancer, too.
Tell the Silver Prince to send some men to the courtyard under my window, he snarled at the guards. They'll find enough fairies' nests there to fill a tub for him with their blood.
Then he went back to his room and read the nests into the trees. But he saw Dustfinger's face through the letters, as if he were living behind them, as if all of the words spoke only of him.
Chapter 67. The Other Name. The castle in the lake had been built to protect a few unhappy children from the world. But the longer Mo walked in its corridors, the more he felt as if it had been waiting for another task to fulfill one day, to drown the blue jay in his own darkness between its painted walls. Dustfinger's fiery wolf ran ahead, as if it knew the way, and while Mo followed, he killed 4 more soldiers. The castle belonged to the Fire Dancer and the Blue Jay. He read it in their faces, and the anger that Orpheus aroused in him made him strike so often that their blood drenched his black clothes. Black. Orpheus's words had turned his heart black, too. You ought to have asked them which way to go instead of killing them, he thought bitterly, as he bent to pass through an arched gateway. A flock of doves fluttered up. No swifts, not one. Where was Risa? Well, where did he suppose? In the Adderhead's bedchamber, searching for the book he had once bound to save her. A swift could fly fast, very fast, and his own steps were heavy as lead from the words Orpheus had written. There. Was that the tower into which the Adderhead had retreated? It was as Dustfinger had described it. 2 more soldiers. They staggered back in horror when they saw him. Kill them quickly, Mo, before they scream. Blood. Blood as red as fire. Hadn't red once been his favorite color? Now the sight of it made him feel ill. He clambered over the dead men, took the silver-gray cloak from one of them, put on the other man's helmet. Maybe the disguise would spare him the killing if he met any more of them. The next corridor looked familiar, but there were no guards in sight. The wolf loped on, but Mo stopped outside a door and pushed it open. The dead books. The lost library. He lowered his sword and went in. Dustfinger sparks glowed in here too, burning the smell of mold and decay out of the air. Books. He leaned the blood-stained sword against the wall, stroked their stained spines, and felt the burden of the words lifting from his shoulders. He was not the Blue Jay, not Silvertongue, just Mortimer. Orpheus had written nothing about the bookbinder. Mo picked up a book. Poor thing, it was a wreck. He took up another, and then another, and heard a rustling sound. His hand immediately went to his sword, and Orpheus's words reached for his heart again. A few piles of books fell over. An arm pushed its way past all the printed corpses, followed by a second arm, without a hand. Balbulus. Ah, it's you they're looking for. He straightened up, ink on the fingers of his left hand. Since I hid in here from the piper, not a soldier's come through this door until today. I expect the moldy smell keeps them away. But today they've been 2 here already. They've certainly kept a better watch on you than you on me. So, how did you escape them? With the help of fire and feathers, said Mo, leaning his sword against the wall again. He didn't want to remember. He wanted to forget the Blue Jay just for a few moments, and find happiness instead of misery among parchment and leather-bound covers. Balbulus followed his glance. No doubt he saw the longing in it. I've found a few books that are still good for something. Do you want to see them? Mo listened for sounds outside. The wolf was silent, but he thought he heard voices. No, they died away again. Just for a few moments, then. Balbulus gave him a book not much bigger than his hand. It had a few holes nibbled in it, but it had obviously escaped mildew. The binding was very well made. His fingers had missed leafing through written pages so much. His eyes were so hungry for words that carried him away, instead of capturing and controlling him. How very much his hand wanted to hold a knife that cut not flesh, but paper. What's that? Whispered Balbulus. It had turned dark. The fire on the walls had gone out, and Mo couldn't see the book in his hands anymore. Silvertongue? He turned. Dustfinger stood in the doorway, a shadow rimmed with fire. I've been talking to Orpheus. His voice sounded different. The composure that death had left in him was gone. His old desperation, almost forgotten by both of them, was back. What's happened? Dustfinger lured fire back out of the darkness and made it build a cage among the books, a cage with a girl in tears inside it. Brianna. Mo saw on Dustfinger's face the same fear he had so often felt himself. Flesh of his flesh. Child. Such a powerful word. The most powerful of all. Dustfinger had only to look at him, and Mo read it all in his eyes. The nightmare watching his daughter,
the price he would have to pay to ransom her. So, Mo listened for sounds outside. Are the soldiers already out there? I haven't laid the trail yet. Mo sensed Dustfinger's fear sharply, as if Meggie were the girl in the cage, as if it were her weeping that came out of the fire. What are you waiting for? Lead them here, he said. It's time my hands bound a book again, even if the job must never be finished. Let them capture the bookbinder, not the blue jay. They won't notice the difference. And I'll banish the blue jay forever, bury him deep in the dungeon cell below, with the words that Orpheus wrote. Dustfinger breathed into the darkness, and instead of the cage, the fire formed the sign that Mo had imprinted on the spines of so many books, a unicorn's head. If that's what you want, he said quietly. But if you're playing the bookbinder again, then what part is mine? Your daughter's rescuer, said Mo. My wife's protector. Risa has gone to look for the white book. Help her to find it and bring it to me. So that I can write the end in it, he thought. 3 words, that's all it takes. And suddenly a thought occurred to him and made him smile in all the darkness. Orpheus had not written anything at all about Risa. Not a single binding word. Who else had he forgotten? Chapter 68 Back. Roxanne was singing again. For the children who couldn't sleep for fear of the milksop. And everything Meggie had ever heard about her voice was true. Even the tree seemed to be listening to her. The birds in its topmost branches, the animals living among its roots, the stars in the dark sky. There was so much comfort in Roxanne's voice. Although what she sang was often sad. And Meggie heard her longing for Dustfinger in every word. It was a comfort to hear about longing, even if it filled her heart to the brim. Longing for sleep, free of fear, and carefree days, for firm ground underfoot, a full stomach, the streets of Ombra, mothers and fathers. Meggie was sitting high up in the tree, outside the nest where Fenolio had sat writing. She didn't know whom to worry about first, Fenolio and the Black Prince, Farid, who had followed the giant with Batista, or Doria, who had climbed down again to find out if the milksop had really left. She tried not even to think of her parents. But suddenly Roxanne began the song about the blue jay that Meggie loved most, because it described his captivity in the Castle of Night with his daughter. Some of the songs were more heroic, but only this one also spoke of her father. And it was her father she missed. Mo, she would so much have liked to ask, putting her head on his shoulder. Do you think the giant is taking Fenolio to his children as a toy? Do you think he'll tread on Farid and Batista and crush them if they try to rescue the prince? Do you think anyone can love 2 boys with just 1 heart? Have you seen Risa? And how are you, Mo? How are you? Has the blue jay killed the adderhead yet? One of the children had asked Eleanor only yesterday. Will he come back soon to save us from the milksop? Of course he will. Eleanor had replied, glancing at Meggie. Of course. The boy's not back yet, she heard Elfbane say to Woodenfoot down below her. Shall I go and look for him? Why do that? Replied Woodenfoot, lowering his voice. He'll come back if he can, and if he doesn't, then they've caught him. I'm sure the soldiers are down there somewhere. I just hope Batista will be careful when he comes back himself. How can he be careful? Asked Elfbane, with a grim laugh. The giant behind him, the milksop in front of him, and the prince probably dead. We'll soon be striking up our own last song, and it won't sound half as good as the songs Roxanne sings. Meggie buried her face in her arms. Don't think about it, Meggie, she told herself. Just don't think about it. Listen to Roxanne. Dream that everything will be all right, that they'll all come back safe and sound. Mo, Risa, Fenolio, the Black Prince, Farid. And Doria. What does the milksop do to prisoners? No, don't think about it. Don't ask such questions. Voices drifted up from down below. Leaning forward, she tried to make something out in the darkness. Was that Batista's voice? She saw fire, just a small flame, but it gave a bright light. There was Fenolio, and the Black Prince on a stretcher beside him. Farid? She called down. Hush!
hissed Elfbane, and Meggie pressed her hand to her mouth. The robbers were letting down ropes and a net to take up the prince.
"Quick, Batista!"
Roxanne's voice sounded so different when she wasn't singing.
"They're coming."
She didn't need to say any more. Horses snorted among the trees. Twigs broke under the tread of many boots. The robbers threw down more ropes, and some let themselves down the trunk. Arrows came out of the darkness. Men swarmed out from the surrounding trees like silver beetles.
"Wait and see. They'll bide their time until Batista comes back with the prince."
Hadn't Doria said so? That was why he had gone down himself. And he hadn't come back. Farid made the fire flare up. He and Batista placed themselves in front of the Black Prince to protect him. The bear was with them too.
"What is it? What's going on?"
Eleanor was kneeling beside Meggie, her hair in wild confusion, as if bristling with fear.
"I'd actually dropped off to sleep, would you believe it?"
Meggie did not reply.
What could she do?
Oh, what could she do? She made her way over to the forked branch where Roxanne and the other women were kneeling. Only two of the robbers were with them. All the others were letting themselves down the trunk to help the prince, but it was a long way to the ground, a terribly long way, and a rain of arrows came from below. Two men fell, screaming, and the women covered the children's eyes and ears.
"Where is he?"
Eleanor leaned so far forward that Roxanne pulled her back by force.
"Where is he?"
she cried again.
"Someone tell me, is that old fool still alive?"
Fenolio looked up at them as if he had heard her voice, his lined face full of fear, the fighting all around him. One man fell dead at his feet, and Fenolio picked up his sword.
"Look at that, will you?" cried Eleanor. "What's he doing? Does he think he can play the hero in his own damn story?"
"I must go down," thought Meggie. "I must help Farid and look for Doria." Where was he? Lying dead somewhere among the trees? No, he can't be. Fenolio wrote about him. Wonderful things. He can't be dead. All the same, she ran to the ropes, but Elfbane stopped her.
"Climb up the tree," he said urgently. "All the women and children must get as far up the tree as they can."
"Oh, yes. And what are we going to do when we reach the top?"
snapped Eleanor.
"Wait for them to pick us off?"
There was no answer to that question.
"They have the prince."
Minerva's voice sounded so desperate that everyone looked around. Some of the women began sobbing. Sure enough, they had the Black Prince. They were dragging him off the stretcher where he lay. The bear lay motionless beside him, with an arrow in his coat. Batista had been captured too.
Where was Farid?
Where the fire was. Farid made it bite and burn, but Sootbird was there too, his leathery face pale above his red and black costume. Fire ate fire. The flames licked up the trunk. Meggie thought she could hear the tree groaning. Several smaller trees had already caught fire. The children were crying hard enough to melt anyone's heart.
"Oh, Fenolio," thought Meggie, "we don't have much luck with the people we call to our aid. First Cosimo, now the giant."
The giant. His face appeared among the trees as suddenly as if the mere word had summoned him. His skin had turned dark as the night, and he wore the reflection of the stars on his brow. One foot trod out the fire that was eating at the roots of their tree. The other foot missed Farid and Sootbird so narrowly that Meggie's own scream echoed in her ears.
"Yes, yes, he's back,"
she heard Fenolio shout. He staggered toward the mighty feet and climbed onto one of its toes as if it were a lifeboat. But the giant looked up at the crying children inquiringly, as if he had come for something that he couldn't find. The milksop's men abandoned their prisoners and ran for their lives again, with their lord in front on his snow-white horse. Only Sootbird stood his ground with a small troop, sending his fire to lick at the giant. The giant stared at the flames, bewildered, and stumbled back when they caught his toes.
"No, please," Meggie called down. "Please don't go away again. Help us!"
And suddenly, Farid was standing on the giant's shoulder, making flakes of fire rain down from the night. They settled on the clothes of Sootbird and his men like burning burrs, until they flung themselves down on the forest floor and rolled over and over on the dry leaves. As for the giant, he looked at Farid in astonishment, plucked him off his shoulder as easily as a moth, and placed him on his raised palm.
How large his fingers were, terribly large, and how small Farid looked standing there beside them. Sutbird and his men were still beating at their burning clothes. The giant stared down at them, irritated. He rubbed his ear as